discharging to high-priority nature sites. By 2050, this will apply to all waterways. But according to analysis of the proposals by the Liberal Democrats, by 2030, there will still be 325,000 sewage dumps a year on Britain's beaches, as well as in lakes, rivers and chalk streams. The Liberal Democrats' environment spokesperson Tim Farron said, "This government's plan is a license to pump sewage onto our beaches and in our treasured rivers and lakes. By the time these flimsy targets come into effect, our beaches would have been pumped full of disgusting sewage, more otters will be poisoned, and our children will still be swimming in dangerous waters. This is a cruel joke. The government is going to hike water bills to pay for cleaning up the mess made by water companies. The same companies who awarded their executives multi-million pound bonuses this year and paid out over £1 billion to their shareholders, while they roll in the cash, we swim in sewage. The whole thing stinks." The government has said that under its plan, bills will not go up until 2025. Sources also said they would not allow companies to profit from environmental damage. Annual bonuses paid to water company executives rose by 20% in 2021, despite most of the firms failing to meet sewage pollution targets. Figures show that on average, executives received £100,000 in one-off payments on top of their salaries, during a period in which foul water was being pumped for 2.7 million hours into England's rivers and swimming spots. George Eustace, the Environment Secretary, said this is the first government to take action to end environmental damage caused by sewage spills. "We will require water companies to protect everyone who uses our water for recreation and ensure storm overflows pose no threat to the environment. Water companies will need to invest to stop unacceptable sewage spills onto our rivers and coastlines, and this can have greater protection than ever before." Jim McMahon, the Shadow Environment Secretary, said, "Instead of governing, it's clear that the Conservatives have taken up writing fiction, as this document is neither a plan nor does it eliminate sewage dumping into our natural environment. Under the government's weak improvement target, based on last year's data, we'd face another 4.8 million sewage spill events in our country between now and 2035. Last year, Tory MPs had the opportunity to vote meaningful action into law, but blocked measures that would have progressively eliminated the discharge of raw sewage in our natural environment. Britain deserves better than a zombie Tory government that is happy for our country to be treated as an open sewer. Labour will use the levers of power to hold reckless water bosses to account legally and financially, and toughen regulations to prevent them from gaming the system." Stuart Singleton White, head of the campaigns at the Angling Trust, said, "Department of the Environment, DEFRA's claim, these are the strictest targets ever for water companies. Sounds impressive. It isn't, and the government knows that it is a weak plan that falls short of what is needed. What's more, this plan falls short of the commitments made in the Environment Act and fails to take on board the recommendations of its own Storm Overflow Task Force. This is a government trying to spin its way out of a problem it only sees as needing to manage from a public relations perspective. Our rivers and coastlines are paying the price for this complacency, and the public are angry."
Economic Divide.
Europe's energy crisis is far from over, but Europe has another big worry to deal with, and that is the upcoming winter, when it's predicted to be extremely cold. How will its citizens deal with not only a high energy cost, but energy rationing? The term heat or eat is no joke when it comes to the European state of affairs on top of inflation. Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway. Welcome to Economic Divide. In this program, we will take a look at Europe's energy crunch. High gas bills, one of the outcomes, Europe to ration energy, something that is now real. Tough winter is projected ahead. Next up, we will take a look at Europe's cost of living crisis. We've covered this before in this program, worth reviewing again when you take a look at things like high inflation and also low purchasing power as a result of high inflation, amongst other prices that is biting into the pocketbook of Europeans. And finally, EU politicians, what are they doing? Well, in essence, they are sacrificing their own citizens. They're not pushing for diplomacy when it comes to the Ukraine conflict. And as a result, an economic crisis has unfolded for them.
As the crisis between Russia and the West heats up, fears are growing in Europe of a gloomy winter. There are now concerns that Russia could turn the gas tap off to Europe. Prices are already high in Europe and the UK.
There is potentially a double parallel between Britain today and Britain in 1973 and thereabouts, in that the inflation which took off in Britain in 1973 and stayed high for the rest of the decade was the first impulse towards inflation was a combination of domestic forces because of global energy prices.
Households in Germany will have to pay almost 500 euros more a year for gas.
There is no relief for Europe and its citizens when it comes to their economic state of affairs. They simply can't keep up or do anything about their money losing its value at this point in time. And that is very evident when you take a look at some online posts on this matter. And then with winter coming, things are looking pretty bad for them. Our first online post, winter in Europe may be springtime for Putin. Taking a look at this entry, we go into the source where it says winter in Europe may be springtime for Putin. Russia's energy war deploys high prices to promote social turmoil and to empower populist parties. Next up, Europe seems to be getting exactly what the U.S. thought Russia was getting, an economic squeeze so bad that it topples leaders. Ouch, that hurts. Then German and French electricity are at record highs of 532 euros per megawatt hour for Germany and 690 euros per megawatt hour for France. Europe on the verge of an energy crisis, and it will be a very cold winter for the region. Then finally, natural gas is being stored and demand is being curbed, but it's far too early to call an end to Europe's fears of a cold, dark winter plagued by blackouts. Now, welcome to Europe's Dark Cold Winter, Elements by Julian Lee, in which it says replenishing storage and reducing demand still may not be enough. So obviously all the online posts that we just reviewed show how bad Europe is going to do and their citizens come winter. Okay, let's bring in our guests for this segment of the Q&A. Our first guest is Malachi Steenson. He's a lawyer and political activist. Malachi Steenson, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at Europeans, they are looking at a really tough winter ahead, of which then the news of gas rationing and energy rationing in particular is what they have announced, and this has actually gone into effect. The shortage in energy to have affected deeply, for example, the UK, where electric bills have tripled. When you take a look at rationing, that really has a shocking ring to it. And of course, the immediate question is when that happens, how will that affect the economy of countries like Germany and the UK?
Well, I mean, I think if we look particularly at Ireland, we're seeing the very same thing, where we're seeing, you know, huge increases in both electricity, gas and oil prices. And I think that the oil companies and the utility companies are using the Ukrainian crisis in order to jack up prices to consumers and to increase profits. I mean, at one hand, they're telling us that the price of these commodities is increasing. Yet at the same time as they increase the price to consumers, their profits are going up by huge margins. So it seems to me there's a certain amount of price gouging in the whole business. I think that the West and the EU in particular are using the Ukrainian crisis in order to bring in further controls on population. I mean, again, if you look at Ireland, we're told we're going to have energy blackouts in the next, during the next winter. But at the same time, our economic policy is geared towards bringing in, for instance, more data centres, which are huge users of electricity in particular, huge users of water resources. And there's no reluctance to say, well, if we're going to be short of electricity and power, then we shouldn't be bringing in these big consumers.
Okay, let me introduce our next guest. Karel Veres Kent joins us. Karel is the VP of the French party by the name of Solidarity and Progress, or Progrès, as they say in French. Karel, welcome to Economic Divide. Europe is forecast to begin this winter with historically low amounts of diesel. And my focus on this question is diesel that powers large parts of the economy in European countries, used for cars, trucks, etc. Now, when you take a look at the way that this actually obviously is one of the components behind the way that the economy and its wheel turn, how will this be supplied if the supplies of diesel are at their lowest this time of the year when it continued from the year 2008?
Well, on the gas situation, there are deals with Azerbaijan, Norway, and Algeria. On the oil, it's probably more complicated because there are all kinds of tricks which are being used by various countries to counter the sanctions. For example, India is buying a lot of Russian oil, which is very cheap, with special discounts, like China also. But India eventually could sell it to other partners in other countries, which then in turn can sell it to the US and to Europe. So everything depends to what degree, you know, the police, the media police and the financial police of the institutions connected to the central banks, will they really impose their policies? But you're absolutely right that diesel is a very clean and cheap energy and efficient energy. And taking it down will only lower the productivity. And then lower productivity means increasing chances of recession, depression, and bankruptcy.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we bring you news with an economic flavor from around the world. Our first item is something to do with kids, the cost of kids. That's right, that has made news, the price of parenthood in the age of inflation. Now, this particular one is for the U.S., where it costs at least $300,000 per kid to raise them. Now, what have they done to come up with that figure? They have factored in the cost of inflation, where it said that a child costs more than a pretty penny for the average American. That price used to be roughly around $200,000 to $250,000. So obviously there was a huge increase when it comes to the cost of kids and raising them. Next up, something that the EU doesn't want to hear about. It's EU bankruptcies from businesses. More EU firms are facing that bleak situation. According to Eurostat, the number of petitions for insolvency has grown for a fourth consecutive quarter. Bankruptcy declarations has increased by 2.2% in the April to June period for the year 2022, another blow to the European economy. And the next up, a piece of news that came out regarding Canada and Canadian worker abuse, where you have a fight that has ramped up to prevent Canadian companies from abusing these workers abroad. Canadian companies have been accused of being complicit in alleged rights abuses and environmental harms. Now, that obviously has to deal with companies that deal with minerals or resources of that nature. And our final look goes to Dubai and the inflation in there. Consumer prices there have rocketed to its highest after years of actual deflation. Maybe you didn't know, but just 3 years ago, Dubai was experiencing the sharpest deflation in the region, peaking at 3.9% annually in February of 2019. So it shows at this point how that has it's gone the opposite way to towards inflation. Those were the topics we picked. Hope you liked them. If you have any particular piece of news that you'd like to share with us from where you are at, please do send them to us.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for an in-depth section of the program. The energy crisis in Europe is real. Many Europeans will not be able to afford their heating bill this winter. And that's going to have severe consequences, unintended ones, for European officials and their countries. Social unrest not that far off. Some have speculated that is what's going to happen. Well, let's take a look at some of the reasons why something like that may occur. Now, electricity prices for the year 2021, Spain and Portugal, 411% increase. I mean, that's a lot, isn't it, for countries to experience that much of an increase. Greece has experienced a 343% increase in their electricity wholesale prices. And also France, which comes in at 336%. A lot. And also, we're looking at other countries that maybe we didn't have time to put here. Last one here, Italy. This has come in at 318%. And this is directly coming from the European Commission in terms of the figures and the increase that you see over here. Now, as energy prices surge, while wages remain unchanged, or maybe just a slight increase, some are living from salary to salary based on what has occurred. And they're being forced to actually decide whether to spend their limited funds on keeping the lights on in their homes or filling the fridge. This is where the term heat or eat has become a catchword for Europeans. That's the stark reality that they're facing. All right, next, energy ministers. Well, they had to do something. They've reached a deal on an EU-wide reduction in gas, which is something they came up with, 15% across the board. They said this first phase will be voluntary based on coordination or fuel switching, temperature limits, and information campaigns. But we have to wait and see whether that can actually be a blanket application for all European countries. That's key over there. Next up, this is something that's really incredible. Now, they're facing an energy crisis, okay? So what they're going to do, they are actually announced that they're prepared to drive up the cost of everyone's heating bills. How is that going to happen? Well, they're going to secure their supply of natural gas for the upcoming winter. But according to the European Union officials, whatever the world market can pay for a tanker transporting a supercooled form of, like, fossil fuel across international waters, Europe will be willing to top it. That's right. So whatever price is out there, they said this formally, made the announcement, we're going to pay a higher price. So there you have it. You have the citizens of these countries that are going to pay higher for that. Let's bring back Malachi Stinson, who's a lawyer and political activist, to see what he thinks about this. Malachi Stinson, welcome back. The EU has agreed to ration gas. That's one of the things that it said it will do. But some countries obviously have put up a fight because every country has its own particular needs when it comes to energy. And, of course, these energy sanctions against Russia are biting their economies. How fragile is this unity against Russia, do you think, at this point, as the economies are tanking and people are suffering?
At the same time, we're telling people, because of climate change and the other the agenda that they're using there to control people, we're saying that you must switch to electric cars. And at the same time, we're telling people, well, you're going to have electrical shortages. You're not going to be able to charge your car. So you're going to be, just like they used COVID to ensure that people were brought under a communist-type control in their countries, where they were afraid to go out the doors, where they were told, you know, that Armageddon was coming and the world was about to end. We're told the same with climate change. And, you know, as Michael O'Leary, the CEO of Ryanair, said the other day, that these people are telling us, for instance, what the temperature would be in 100 years, and they can't tell us what next Tuesday's weather will be like. So it seems to me to be a whole agenda being pursued, which is not in the interest of the ordinary consumer, and it's not in the interest of the ordinary member of the public. It's a policy that's being pursued, on one hand, to create and move capital into fewer and fewer hands, and also at the same time to move power into this European federal state almost, and into the powers of unelected bureaucrats.
Okay, let's see what Karel Veresken thinks. He's the VP of the French party, Solidarity and Progress, who rejoins us. Karel, welcome back. A month ago, we saw how Europe was facing an energy rationing scheme, which it says it's going to enact as the tough winter, which has been predicted is going to be tough, is looming. You're looking at the shortage that has really catapulted gas prices and energy prices into a whole nother level, like in the UK, where it's tripled. Germany is also affected very severely. What effects will this rationing, when it really goes into full-fledged execution, have on the economy of these countries?
Well, it's a fast trip to disaster, because it's there is an alignment of several planets which are predicting that this will lead us to total collapse. First of all, for the European economy, it means losing the market in Russia, which for some factors in some areas is very important. Secondly, we're losing the arrival of raw materials for the production. Three, the higher cost of energy, because will bring down productivity. The model of the reconstruction of Europe after the war is to have cheap energy and invested in highly productive industry and agriculture. For example, people in Germany talk about the end of the German model, because they will not have the cheap energy to build machines they can export and sell for high prices. Then on top of this, we have the drought, which is slowing down our nuclear power plants, which cannot be cooled, notably in France. But also it is impacting transport, like the Danube and the Rhine River. The Rhine is now below 40 centimeters, which means a lot of shipping inland, waterways cannot really function.
The industrial Northwest Europe is likely to face diesel shortages this winter. Diesel power covers large parts of the economy. Diesel shortages, along with falling levels of heating oil, could further weaken the economy and to prompt more protests across the continent. Gas rationings and possible shutdowns could potentially trigger social unrest and dissatisfaction among the poorer sections of European societies. Strikes have already erupted in several countries, including the UK, Belgium, and Spain. Governments are aware that people are struggling, and they know that things will get worse in the coming months.
I think our problem now is a lack of knowledge. We don't have anybody around in politics who can remember what it was like with inflation. Certainly not in office, and indeed many of them not at all, because you know, this is quite a young generation of politicians we know about now. So I think there's a danger in possibly in the other direction. That people are slightly lost.
We have told you about Europe's energy problem, but perhaps no country in Europe is facing an energy crisis like Germany. Let us count the reason why. The scale of the problem for Germany is so big that this headline reads a doomsday scenario. According to Bloomberg, Germany is at a risk of deindustrialization. It states that soaring power prices may trigger an exodus of factories from the country. Prices for gas and electricity in Germany have reportedly more than doubled in the past 2 months. There's another point that is not covered when it comes to Germany, and that is how they have moved to green energy from a long time ago under a program called Energiewende. Energiewende gained legislative support in 2010, and Germany spent over 202 billion euros on renewable energy projects from 2013 to 2020. Since 2010, the share of German electricity generation that has come from solar and wind power has risen from 8% to 31%. Now Germany may reopen its coal plants that it had shut down. They have no choice in order to safeguard their economy and national security. Don't forget, coal is the dirtiest source of electricity. Nevertheless, Germany has told its citizens that they have to face the stark truth when it comes to energy use. The German government has urged its citizens to lower energy use. They require citizens to turn down their air conditioners and use less hot water. Let's end this segment by bringing up another point that is the following. What are the safest and cleanest sources of energy? Fossil fuels are the dirtiest and most dangerous energy sources, while nuclear and modern renewable energy sources are vastly safer and cleaner. The differences are huge. So it is quite hypocritical of Western governments to tell Iran to stop its civilian use of nuclear energy. That does it for this segment. Hope you found it useful. When European countries began confronting Russia after Russia's special military operation against Ukraine, did they really know what they were getting themselves into? I mean, first of all, let's be clear, I'm not trying to justify the war or the death of civilians. But as the war dragged on, did the Europeans really want to continue down this path, one in which they are now facing things like lack of food, inflation, or high energy costs? Even now, do they want a political solution for the sake of at least not ruining their economies, let alone their citizens? Or are they following the U.S. diktats while risking a potential either Third World War or, worse yet, a nuclear catastrophe? These are key questions that the European officials need to deal with. We'll find out, hopefully sooner than later, what they decide. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mikhail Vitakli and team, looking forward to seeing you next week.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-coloured sand. In the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh, I slept a lot. I have to get up. Time for breakfast and a new beautiful summer day in Kashan. Thank God I can make tea in an old Iranian teapot and samovar here. Hi, Mom. I'm fine, thanks. Actually, I've resided in the famous Amerihah house. For today, I'm going to visit the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Thank you. Bye-bye. The historical Kashan Bazaar is one of the must-see attractions of the city of Kashan and also one of the most significant traditional bazaars of Iran that will amaze visitors with its artistic architecture and nostalgic atmosphere. Just like other traditional bazaars of Iran that are considered as the main elements of the city's old texture, the roofed Kashan Bazaar is surrounded with other historical monuments of the city like old mosques, caravanserais, abambar or water cisterns, covering an area known as the city's old district. This bazaar dates back to the Buyid and Seljuqid eras. It started booming during the Safavid era, and what is remained is a bazaar which is built on the remains of the old bazaar during the Qajarid era. This bazaar is registered in Iran National Heritage List. Time to go. Yes, I'm going to visit the Bazaar of Kashan today.
but I'm afraid it's not possible to visit the entire bazaar in just half a day. Kashan is a very special city, full of old stunning sights. So here it is. Good. Not a long way to go. Oh God. Look at the city. I'm crazy about these adobe-made walls. This city looks like a history book. I'm excited to visit this bazaar. It's said this bazaar has been one of the most important trade centers of the past until today. Well, I am now at the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Wow. Just from the entrance of this bazaar, you can guess this market is an Iranian Islamic architectural masterpiece. The architecture and main structure of this bazaar looks like all bazaars of Iran. This bazaar constitutes different sections like Raste, Sara, Timche, and Chahar Sogh. I am now in Mianchal Chahar Sogh. Well, it has old wooden gates. You may not believe, but this Chahar Sogh is one of the most beautiful sections of this market. Here I am in Aminodole Timche. This part of the bazaar is the old section of the bazaar. The entrance of Aminodole Timche has tile works. This section is surrounded by old wooden windows and old bricks. This part of the bazaar has astonishing architecture. Most of the carpet selling stores are in this Timche. And here we have the copper market, one of the attractive sections of the bazaar, in my opinion. Yes, the familiar sound of hammers on copper. I may buy these cooking wares. Oh, very beautiful. Good souvenirs. Well, art is long and time is short. Of course, the traditional bazaar of Kashan is more than what I described for you, but I have to come back to Tehran before night. In the future, I may come back here to see the details of this astonishing bazaar of beautiful Iran. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country. In the Imam Khomeini Hosseini on July 27, 2022.
The people's presence is the foundation. When we recite words remembering Allah in a group, the effects and blessings of it descend upon the group. In the Quran, it is stated that, for admonition indeed benefits the faithful. The Quran, Surah 51, verse 55. Everyone benefits from it. Yes, even when you pray the night prayer in solitude in your room, the Almighty Allah will still bestow its benefits on you. But here, during the Friday prayer, this benefit is a public benefit. Everyone benefits from it. Or consider the verse, Remember me and I will remember you. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 152. I will remember you. This special grace from God is a result of dhikr. Dhikr here is remembering God in a group. So the grace that is granted is for the whole group. Or, and remember Allah greatly so that you may be felicitous. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 45. And many of the verses that are in the Quran. I referred to Al-Mu'jam Al-Mufahras, Quranic Index. And these few verses came to mind for now, which I've written down. If you search, there are plenty of verses that talk about the blessings that dhikr brings. This is one feature, the collective remembrance of Allah and its blessings.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next feature is the continuity of this event, these weekly meetings. Well, the Hajj pilgrimage is once in a person's lifetime. That's how it usually is. But this Friday prayer is a weekly event. This is very important. As far as I am aware, and I've done some research on this, there is no other spiritual gathering in any religion, in any place, where the people of a city or a large group of people in a city gather in a central place together on a weekly basis. What the content of this gathering should be constitutes the next issue. This is a very important feature. This is where the excellence of this gathering becomes evident, even in comparison to Hajj. It takes place one week after another. This week, next week, the week after that, and so on. Well, this is an example of what we read in Dua Kumail, so that my works and litanies may all be a single litany, and my occupation with your service everlasting. It's continuous. It's not a matter of being there one day and absent the next, or being present in one place but not being present somewhere else. I need to be continually at your service, and my occupation with your service everlasting. This is how this weekly gathering is. This is how my occupation with your service everlasting can be carried out.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. From all the ways that were wrong, indeed you
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Trump's claim that America has become more violent and dangerous over the last year and a half is true, says Robert Ray Schreider in an article published under the heading, The Violence at the Heart of Trumpism. Stay tuned for more. Among the many ironies and hypocrisies leading up to the 2022 midterms, one deserving special mention is Trump's and the GOP's statement that America has become more violent and dangerous under Biden and the Democrats. Our country is now a cesspool of crime, Trump said in a recent speech to the America First Policy Institute, adding, We have blood, death, and suffering on a scale once unthinkable because of Democrat Party's effort to destroy and dismantle law enforcement all throughout America. The truth is that although Americans experience far more gun violence than the inhabitants of other advanced nations, that's largely because of widespread gun ownership, championed, encouraged, and defended by Republican lawmakers. The larger threat of violence is coming from Trump Republicans, whose incendiary statements are fueling violence and threats of violence across America. In the year and a half since a pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol, such threats and attacks have escalated. Recently, a federal jury found Barry Croft and Adam Fox guilty in a plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer at her summer home and to blow up a bridge that would stop rescuers from reaching her. They hope to speak and spark a second American revolution. The Trump Republican violence machine is affecting and sometimes intimidating election workers, flight attendants, school board officials, librarians, members of the Biden administration, and members of Congress. In Houston, a former Marine stepped down as the Grand Marshal of a July 4th parade after a deluge of threats that focused on her support of rights. A few weeks later, the mayor of Oklahoma City quit his job after what he described as a series of threats and attacks bordering on violence. His tires were slashed, he was harassed by residents at a council meeting and followed near his home. He said, I was afraid, what would they do next if I don't step down? Dr. Anthony Fauci and his family have received credible death threats and required a security detail. In December, authorities in Iowa arrested a California man with an assault rifle and ammunition, and a hit list that named Dr. Fauci and Joe Biden among others. Congresswoman Liz Cheney has also received credible death threats and also has a security detail. Threats have been issued against the federal judge who authorized the warrant to search for classified material at Mar-a-Lago and against his family. In that search, FBI agents carted away boxes of highly sensitive documents. During that search from which FBI agents carted away boxes of highly sensitive material, Trump described his home as under siege. In the wake of the surge, Trump's social media platform, Truth Social, erupted in calls for violence. Twitter saw a tenfold increase in posts mentioning civil war. There was also a spike in social media users calling for violence toward law enforcement, as Representatives Caroline B. Maloney, chairwoman of the House Oversight Committee, and Stephen Lynch, chairman of its National Security Subcommittee, noted in a letter last week to 8 social media companies. Republican lawmakers have fueled the fire. Representative Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, has accused the Justice Department of being weaponized against Trump. Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, and Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, have drawn comparisons between the FBI and the Nazi secret police. Joe Kent, a Trump-endorsed House candidate in Washington State, charged on a podcast run by Stephen Bannon that we are at war. Carrie Lake, the Republican nominee for governor of Arizona, declared, "These tyrants will stop at nothing to silence the patriots who are working hard to save America," adding that, "If we accept it, America is dead." The incendiary talk has led to violence. On August 11th, a Trump supporter identified as Ricky W. Schiffer mounted an armed attack on an FBI office in Ohio and was killed. According to a subsequent review of his social media post, Schiffer was incensed about the search at Mar-a-Lago and wanted revenge. Robert Pape, a professor at the University of Chicago who studies political violence, has conducted half a dozen nationwide polls since the January 6 attack on the Capitol and repeatedly found that between 15 million and 20 million American adults believe that violence would be justified to return Trump to office. Trump's claim that America has become more violent and dangerous over the last year and a half is true. It is largely because of Trump and the Republican violence machine he has created.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Saudi lid-war on Yemen is still taking its toll on the nation, even under the UN brokered truce. Yemen's Ministry of Health has held a press briefing in Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the Saudi aggression and the impact of the ongoing siege of Yemen.
We held this press conference to review the impact of the Saudi aggression since its beginning, as well as the aftermath of the siege amid the UN armistice, which unfortunately did not change anything. There are tragedies caused by the Saudi-led coalition throughout the years of war, as health facilities and workers have been targeted, and we explain to the world what is happening in our country under the eyes of the United Nations and with the support of the US, Britain, and the rest of major powers.
The ministry says the ongoing Saudi blockade is threatening the lives of thousands of patients by preventing them from traveling for treatment and blocking medical supplies from entering the country.
The blockade is part of the fierce war on Yemen and has directly affected the health sector due to a lack of fuel and failure to fully open the Sana'a International Airport. There are more than 32,000 patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Saudi Arabia also tends to prevent the entry of medicines that are essential for the treatment of millions, including radioactive iodine, which is used to treat cancer patients.
Even though the United Nations managed to declare a nationwide ceasefire back in April, it has failed to relieve the humanitarian situation in Yemen, as Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on all sorts of imports into the country.
According to health officials, 19 million Yemenis don't have access to basic health care services. They say the United Nations is concentrating its efforts on the Russia-Ukraine war, while it should also put more efforts into Yemen to save the lives of millions of women and the children.
Monsoon rains are still pounding Pakistan, hampering all sorts of communications in key cities and towns in four provinces of the country. Roads, houses, hotels and buildings, along with other infrastructures, have been washed away by the flood waters. Southwestern Balochistan and northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces are now in the spotlight due to the sheer magnitude of devastation witnessed there in recent days. That's while millions of Pakistanis ravaged by extreme flooding are still awaiting relief in remote rural areas.
As far as government support is concerned, I think they supported only 50%. A lot of complaints from the local communities that there is no support received so far from the government. They are demanding shelters, food items, and a lot of other things.
Across large swaths of Pakistan, houses, schools, roads, and bridges have been destroyed. Floods also left thousands displaced and struggling to find safety along with their livestock. Meanwhile, Shehbaz Sharif has visited the heavily affected areas. He has already appealed to the international community to send aid and relief to help them deal with the devastation.
We are doing our best to help flood-affected people. The 30-year record of monsoon has been broken this year. The situation is demanding that we all should rise above the politics and to help the flood victims to overcome their miseries.
Pakistan is 8th on the Global Climate Risk Index for being one of the most vulnerable countries in the face of extreme weather caused by climate change. The country witnessed more rain than ever recorded this monsoon season.
It has been a year since the U.S. missile withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Taliban takeover of the country. During the pullout, thousands of Afghans flocked to airports in hope of leaving the country along with the U.S. forces. Zaki was one of them. As the Taliban encircled Kabul on August 15, hundreds of Afghans swarmed the runway of Hamid Karzai International Airport, attempting to climb onto a U.S. Air Force transport plane. Zaki made his way to the front and clambered onto the plane's landing gear. As it accelerated past 120 miles per hour, he held tight. His body was found after he plunged from the U.S. military plane as it took off, one of the most tragic and indelible images in the final chapter of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan. We spoke to Zaki's father 1 year after his son's death. It wasn't easy to convince him at first, but this is our mission, to be the voice of the voiceless.
I just want to see the pilot of the U.S. plane to understand how he could do this. The U.S. claims that it supports human rights, but this is